The scripture reading this morning will come from Mark chapter 3, verses 20 through 23. Mark 3, 20 through 23. And I'll be reading from the New King James Version. Then the multitude came together again, so that they could not so much as eat bread. But when his own people heard about this, they went out to lay hold of him, for they said, "He is out of his mind." And the scribes who came down from Jerusalem said, "By the ruler of the demons, he casts out demons." So he called them to himself and said to them in parables, "How can Satan cast out Satan?"
Good morning. We are going to continue our series that we began last week. I kind of hinted last week that the Strongman series started out with kind of a preface or a prologue. That sermon kind of skipped a bit of the discussion we wanted to have. In talking about the man with the withered hand and the miracle, we got an idea of the concept of the power of Jesus on display in his power over disease. But what we're going to see this week is really the first chapter of this thought that we're going to develop for the next several weeks throughout the summer. And that is that Jesus recognizes, or rather would be recognized by his power. He is going to demonstrate power, or we could say it like this, without any of the typical markers of strength, Jesus is going to show us that he is strong enough to be Lord. He does not come into Jerusalem with martial strength. He doesn't come in with a military. He doesn't come in with wealth. He doesn't come in with status or any of the elements that usually identify people of power. In fact, Jesus is in every way the opposite of those. Jesus is a person who has nowhere to lay his head. He is a person whose social status is laughably low. And as far as military strength, every time he gathers a crowd, he tries to disperse them. And so he's really not building a very good army. He sends out his soldiers out into the limited commission. He says, "But don't take an extra coat. People will provide for you." This is not good logistics for building a military, right? He doesn't have any of those typical markers of strength or power. And yet in all of that, not in spite of it, but through it, he is going to consistently demonstrate that he has the power to make him Lord, and that we need to come to grips with that. Today in our text in Mark chapter 3, verses 20 and following, in addition to all that, we get to have a discussion about one of my favorite topics, and that is the issue of morality. And when I talk about morality, and when this text talks about morality, we're not talking about some of the, can I call them smaller issues of morality? And what do you mean by that? I thought it was all important. It is. But there are a lot of moral issues we talk about in churches that are symptoms of a disease. And treating the symptoms, we all know, is a short-term strategy. Treating symptoms is ultimately not a solution. What Jesus does in this passage is take the issue head-on in a discussion of whether or not there is such a thing as good and evil and whether it can be recognized. The deepest moral dilemma of our late modern world is not what is evil. It is whether or not there is such a thing. The questions we get distracted by are, is that thing evil? Is that thing evil? Is this thing good? Is that thing good? That's what we get distracted by. But the deeper debate underneath all others that our culture is actually going through is whether or not there is actually such a thing as objective morality at all. If I can give you just a brief historical tour through philosophy of the last 500 years, what the project called modernism did that came about in Europe in the late medieval period was an effort to sever the tie between the authority of the church and the authority of the state. The princes of the earth were tired of taking their orders from the Pope of Rome. And so they start distancing the culture and the state from the church, which has some value. It means you don't have to take orders from the Pope anymore. But the downside to that is, right and wrong, instead of being rooted in a religious system or in a body of truth is now kind of untethered, and it's just kind of floating out there in the air. If this king says something's wrong, then I suppose it is for today. But what if he changes his mind tomorrow? And it gets kind of dicey after that. For several hundred years, it didn't make a lot of difference, because religious thought was so deeply ingrained in people that they just kind of kept on under the inertia of doing those things. That basically people lived out a form of Christian morality because that's what people did. But as you get further and further from the source, that inertia starts to slow down. And sure enough, people start to wonder, was there anything tying us to right and wrong in the first place? And so what modernism ultimately did was undermine the foundation of whether or not there is such a thing as right and wrong. And so the 20th century ushered in a philosophical movement that, and if you want a really good rant on this, talk to Devin. He's got a fun little speech about postmodernism and how there's no such thing, and he's mostly right. But the thing that calls itself postmodernism, right? Is that okay, Devin? That which calls itself postmodernism was the 20th century notion that modernism had failed and we needed something else. Modernism had corrupted the foundation of morality. Postmodernism said, I guess we can do without. And that is the cultural world that we now live in, where there's some people in our culture who are still living out the inertia of Christian values. They're not sure if they believe on them, and they don't know where they come from. But because it's kind of socially acceptable, more or less, some places in red states or wherever, you know, in some places, in some cultures, you live by certain values, right? If you're in the Bible Belt, you figure, well, grandma's going to get me, and so I better behave. And you keep doing it, even though you don't believe in God or have a deep commitment to that, you just kind of live it out. But increasingly, that is giving way to a point of view that says, really, there's no such thing. In postmodern thought, there's no such thing as good and evil. There is power and powerlessness. There is bias and perspective. There's just differing points of view. And in a world like that, there's no actual evil in the world. The funny consequence that no one talks about, there's also no actual good in the world, because everything's just a matter of point of view. Now you might say, what is this passage in Mark going to have to do anything to do with that? Because it is a discussion of what recognizing what evil is and where its power lies. The question here is not postmodernism or modernism. This is 2,000 years in our rearview mirror. But it is a people who are struggling to recognize whether or not evil is evil, and whether or not good is good. And they've gotten to a point where they struggle to tell the difference. And the reason they struggle to tell the difference is because somebody else has been in charge for too long. I said last week we sing a lovely song, This Is My Father's World. And I'm not telling you not to sing it, by the way. I love that hymn. But the rest of the song should say, but we don't act like it. Right? This is my father's world, but somebody else has been masquerading as the ruler for way too long. And we've gotten used to that, so much so that we are confused by anybody else. Read with me just briefly verses 20 through 22 and see if I can get you from where I'm philosophizing over here to the text. Verses 20 through 22. In most of your Bibles, by the way, there's going to be some kind of paragraph break between verses 21 and 22, like they're completely different stories. I think they're deeply connected, and Mark put them together on purpose, so I'm going to read them together, 20 through 22. Then he went home, and the crowd gathered again so they could not even eat. And when his family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were asking, he is out of his mind. And the scribes who came down from Jerusalem were saying, he is possessed by Beelzebub, and by the prince of demons, he cast out demons. So what's happening in both of those little scenes that are married together in Mark's gospel is that Jesus is becoming wildly popular because he is doing miracles that simply can't be ignored. Well, if you can't ignore it, what do? We move on to explaining it. And everybody starts now making their assumptions about what's going on. And the fact that they can't look at it and immediately know what it means is proof that someone else has been in charge of this world too long. Do you understand? Think for a moment. Take yourself back to history and go into World War II, and you live in France. You live in France, and the Germans have already come in. The Germans have come in, they take over, and they set up kind of a Vichy regime that it's a French government, but it's not very French, right? It's a French government, but it answers to the Nazi high command, okay? Now, let's say you grew up in that environment. Let's say World War II didn't happen, and that situation in France continued for decades. And you grew up in France. You're born in France, you grew up in France, never knowing anything else except this Vichy regime that answers to the Nazis. You would have a hard time recognizing what rightful authority in your country looks like. All you've ever known was the fraud. All you've ever known was the deception and the lie. Someone else who had taken your country by force and was imposing rule on you, but not rightfully. Someone else should be in charge. In some absolute sense, somebody else rightfully was in charge. But the person actually acting out the orders of everyday life was the fraud. Can you imagine the world of confusion? Explain that to your five-year-old. Okay, this is the person, he's in charge of our country, except he's not in charge of our country. He works for the bad guys who run our countries, but we're not the bad guys. I mean, it's confusing to explain. Once that gets ingrained in your culture, it's hard to explain that. That's what has happened to our world. There is someone, a being of consummate evil, who has been masquerading as Lord for too long. The Bible's careful, never calls him Lord. Likes to call him a prince, right? A diminutive title. He's a person with some power. He looks like he's in charge, but he's no Lord. A prince of the power of the air. But there is someone else who's been masquerading, and because of that, we can no longer recognize the real thing. So his family, the people who ideally would know him the very best, look at Jesus and they say, what? He's out of his mind. Jesus, the only person in human history who has ever actually made any sense. Every other philosopher, every other how-to guide, every other life coach has been inconsistent and fallible and flawed deeply, personally, and in their ideas. One man came and lived a perfect life. One man comes and shows us how to live a life in his image. And one man teaches the sensible truth of God's own revealed will. And they look and they say, that's crazy talk. Folks, there is no deeper testament to the influence of Satan in this world in that we no longer know what he looks like. That we see truth and we think it's madness. And if you think it's not true, go into the public world, to the public arena of ideas, and speak out Christian doctrine. And you're going to immediately be told, yeah, we don't talk like that anymore. You've got to dial that down. Or as the, which British politician was it, that was asked about Christianity and said, yeah, we don't do that here anymore. Right? There was an idea that you can be Christian in Great Britain, but not publicly. I mean, you don't run for office as a Christian person. You run for office as a whatever candidate party you are, and you try to kind of tuck away Christianity. Right? Because there is this de facto idea in that culture that if you're Christian, you might be a little crazy. You know, those Christians, they have values. They may not be ours. We don't like that. And so the British politician said, yeah, we don't do that here, referring to Christianity. So you see the point? That at some point, when someone else has been in charge and speaking his lie so long, when you hear truth, it's so easily confused with madness. Now, if you think madness is bad, and it is, the scribes and the Pharisees are going to go a little bit further. They say, no, we have an even better explanation. They don't think Jesus is irrational. You see, his family knows him well enough to say, we don't think he's a bad person. He's just gone crazy. But the Pharisees are not so kind. They say, no, we think he's perfectly rational. We think he is in a fine state of mental health. We think he is an agent of evil. He cast out demons by the power of Beelzebub. Beelzebub being this kind of Aramaic term for this, you can see it defined differently, but something along the lines of the prince of dung, the god of the flies, the lord of decay and filth. It was their way of describing, again, consummate evil. Unlike us, they actually believed in evil, but were so blinded by it that they weren't sure any longer who was who. And they look at this man. Pause a moment and see if you can see their logic. Twisted as it is, there's a little bit of logic behind it. If you're in World War II France, someone else is in charge, and then you see a man issuing orders and people obey him, what would you assume? Well, he must be one of them. He must be one of the Nazis. He must be influential because everybody obeys him. And so they look at Jesus casting out demons and unwilling to contemplate any other possibility that was going to get them into some trouble personally. They said there is a simple explanation of this. A person who orders demons must be a high-ranking demon. We've met the four-star general of the demons. He casts out demons and they respond to him because he works for their boss. Now again, there's a little bit of twisted logic underneath that when you think about it. But the fact that it even is conceivable demonstrates how twisted our reasoning has become under the influence of sin and of evil and of the perpetrator of evil, the author of evil, that Jesus himself will now explain to us. Beginning in verse 23, he says, "And he called to them and said to them in parables, 'How can Satan cast out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand.'" So first of all, Jesus says, let's use a little more logic. You've got just enough logic to be dangerous. Let's try just a little bit more. He says, does this actually make sense? First of all, notice, he does not rebuke them for suggesting that there is evil in the world. He doesn't say, Beelzebub, might as well believe in the boogeyman. He says, oh no, you're absolutely right. There is evil in the world. In fact, I know him better than you do. His name is Satan. We'll call him by name now. And he calls him out. He says, there is real evil in the world, personal evil, a being of consummate evil. He exists. Jesus says, oh, yes. But does it make any sense that a being of consummate evil is in opposition to evil? Because after all, what was the discussion? When Jesus casts out demons, he's not making people sicker. These are not people with, can I make up a pseudo-medical spiritual term? These are not people with benign demons. Okay? You go to the doctor and they say you have a tumor, but it's benign, it's okay. Meaning you've got it, but it's not going to do you any harm. These are not benign demons. These are people that are being thrashed about and torn apart by some kind of personal evil influence in their life, that even, again, transcends our ability to comprehend, because I don't know much about demons. Haven't tried to learn, to be perfectly honest with you. There's a joke in there about beg somewhere, but I'm going to skip that for now. I'll come back to it. Instead, what Jesus says is it rational to say that this consummate evil, who has so ensnared the entire world as to seemingly, though not really, wrest control of it away from God, does it make sense that he has now decided to be confused and he's issuing orders in opposition to himself? That he's now decided to start helping people would be the best way to pursue his campaign of ultimate destruction and chaos? Does this make a lot of sense? He says, would he be in charge if that's the way he acted? Can a house divided against itself stand? What Jesus is claiming is, yes, there is real evil in the world, but here's the part you forgot. When you see someone, a person who is fighting against evil, That person isn't it. When you see someone with every fiber and substance of their being is opposing the evil in the world in ways never before known or seen, as they would say on many occasions, we've never seen it like this before. That person is not an agent of evil. That person is the good guy in this hero story. He's the one who is demonstrating power over evil. Not the power of evil, power over evil. And that's the lesson he's trying to teach them. And then just to make sure they catch on, I enjoy verse 26 because of the irony. There's kind of a knockout punch to this particular lesson. He says, and if, don't miss the if, okay? And if Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand but is coming to an end. Verse 26 is the knockout punch. Even if you're right, you're wrong. Even if today Satan has gotten so confused that he is now opposing himself, don't complain. Sit back and cheer. This is great news. When evil starts imploding and self-destructing, hey, we can applaud that. This is great. He says, you shouldn't be mad about that. But of course, he's being a little facetious, isn't he? He says, no part of this makes any sense. And he says, I think deep down you know it. But the lies of this world has made it easier to accept more lie than to acknowledge the truth and what's going on in this world, which is where he finally comes in verse 27 to the theme text that this entire series has been built around that I mentioned last week. But no one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man. Then indeed, he may plunder his house. What is he saying? He is answering our previous question. Is there such a thing as actual evil in the world? He says, yes, there is. You live in a house that has been influenced and controlled by a man who seemed to have strength. I don't think Jesus is actually saying that Satan has any strength. I'll say something maybe mildly controversial. I don't think Satan has any actual power. I don't think he has any actual strength. But he is mighty in the illusion of strength. He has a gift of deceit, if you can call it a gift. He has a power of influence. And because of that, like a Vichy regime, he has taught us to believe that he's in charge and his way is inevitable and right. And you believe it too, by the way. Here's how I know you believe it. When someone gives you an idealized version of the way things should be, how often have you used this phrase? But I live in the real world. Let's get back to the real world. Okay? Someone tells you, this is the way it ought to be. Everyone ought to be honest. They ought to play fair. We ought to follow the rules. This is the way it ought to be. And you say, yes, but I live in the real world. Every one of us has used that phrase. What are we subtly admitting? That there's an actual world where evil is in charge. That there's an actual world that has become normal for us. So normal, in fact, that we would shudder to think it would ever be different. That we refuse to ever live our lives under the assumption that this devil is not actually in charge. We live believing there is a real world and it's the one with evil in it. Jesus says there is evil in the world, but let me tell you the reality. I am here to conquer it. He is going to bind the alleged strong man. He is going to demonstrate power. And every time he cast out a demon, it wasn't a sign that he was in collusion with evil. It was a sign that he had power over it. It was an act of conquest. And act by act, he demonstrates greater and greater power over the lie that has captured our imagination and our hearts. And the challenge of the gospel is his persistent call to start living in his world rather than this one we think is so real. To start living in a world where Jesus is actually Lord. It's the most basic confession of the Christian faith. Jesus is Lord. And it is the most difficult part of our religion. because everything in this world seems to cry out that he's not. Jesus says, who do you believe the strong man actually is? I am here to do battle with evil. Who do you think actually wins? Now live like it. Act like it. Think like it. There is actual evil in the world, but it's not Jesus. Jesus is the one who has come to defeat it. What if we thought like that on a regular basis? Do you see how differently that would shape the way you think about the world? It explains Jesus to a T, by the way. When you see Jesus get upset with people, okay, chapter back in the book of Mark, his disciples are walking through the field and they're plucking grains off of the wheat, and the Pharisees come along and say, hey, you're not supposed to do that. And Jesus loses his mind. He says, are you crazy? Why does he get so upset about that? Because Jesus has come to do battle with actual evil, and they're arguing over cosmetic nonsense. They can't even tell what the real evil is anymore. A man cast out demons and they oppose him. He heals on the Sabbath and they condemn him. His disciples eat a little wheat and they find a way to criticize him. He says, do you have any idea what's going on here? Church, do we do the same thing? Do we fight cosmetic battles in a world where Satan really and actually exists? And where Jesus has called upon his people to live a life in constant battle with that evil. Real, actual evil. In real, actual submission to Christ, we stand and oppose it. And so Mark has already given away the secret. Mark has told us how we're supposed to be living our lives. He gave it away in the first chapter. He couldn't contain himself. He hadn't even got to the question yet. He gave us the answer. Back in Mark chapter 1 in verse 27, we get this brief story. Jesus has cast out a demon. And the text says this, and they were all amazed. So they questioned among themselves, saying, what is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him. We are all forced to come to grips with the power and might demonstrated by Jesus Christ. Our choice is to decide what to do with it. Is Christianity madness, like his family thought of the teachings of Jesus? Is Christianity just another set of perspectives in a world gone mad? Or is the gospel of Jesus Christ the story of the Lord of the universe vanquishing the powers of evil in this world, and we are called to live under his lordship as supreme? That's the challenge set before you today. Jesus is risen from the dead. The facts are in. The only question is your verdict. What will you do with this Jesus who has acted so mightily to fight the evil that hurts us so much? We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. If there's anything we can do to help you make that decision, won't you come?